Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to find love in the 21st century? And how many frogs does one have to kiss before one of them turns into a handsome prince? Bob Morris found himself with a dual challenge starting in 2000. Soon after his mother died following a long illness, his 80-year-old father was ready to start all over again. But with only a cell phone at his assisted living center, he couldn't call the 900 numbers listed in the personals page of his local Jewish newspaper. So he asked his son to call for him. Morris, meanwhile, was in his mid-40s and unhappily single. While his brother was married and friends pairing off left and right, Morris admitted to being picky, highly opinionated, and terrified of commitment. But he went with renewed enthusiasm into the world of internet dating, hoping to meet his own handsome prince. What followed for father and son was what Morris calls the year of dating dangerously. Bob Morris is a writer, commentator, and playwright who contributed the Age of Dissonance column to the New York Times for 8 years. His new book is called Assisted Loving, True Tales of Double Dating with My Dad. Bob, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
You asked your father why he needed to start dating again in the first place after 50 years of marriage.
Oh, yes, I did.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to have it. I mean, you know, the situation was appalling to me. He handed me that personals page. He said, there are three ladies here that I would like you to call for me because I don't know how to do it. I said, Dad, Mom is dead, what, 4 or 5 months? Why don't you mourn? Why can't you be alone? I'm single. I'm fine alone. What does this need to be in love about? And he said, because it worked so beautifully with your mother for 50 years that I just have to do it again.
So you can't argue with that.
And you can't argue with that. In fact, it actually disarmed me.
Can you describe your dad for us, maybe some of the pros and cons of his personality and his looks as you saw them at the time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he definitely is aged. He was aging well. He looked good for 80, silver hair, jaunty. I think that basically he thought he might have been Perry Como or Andy Williams. He was one of those. He wasn't a golfer, but he definitely had that easygoing, you know, happy-go-lucky kind of guy.
And he was funny.
And he left trails of debris wherever he went. So, you know, 75 bank accounts because, you know, he opened bank accounts to get free toasters in the 50s. And, you know, what else? Little, they looked like science projects, the little foods that he would leave on the counter. You know, blueberries soaking in orange juice for some kind of a dessert concoction. And, oh, of course, tea bags drying everywhere. And, you know, everything he touched turned a little bit sloppier, for sure. His car was beyond. I mean, that was just a lab waiting to happen. We once found a veal chop in his tennis bag that had been smelling. Whatever, you know, 8,000 brochures for places he would never go. Scraps of paper with song lyrics written on them. 8 tennis rackets, 50,000 tennis balls. He was wild. He was his own man.
So it's tough to put that sort of thing on Match.com and expect any bites.
Well, we never put him on the internet. I was actually scared to set him up with email because I knew I would just be getting emails every other minute. Because he was a very affable and charming, sociable character. But I did end up calling, you know, I mean, the beginning of Assisted Loving is pretty much me calling these women in this personals ad that he gave me. You know, he'd circled 3 ads, and I am going to say to his credit that they were age-appropriate, Chris. I mean, they weren't. We're not talking about him chasing 40-year-olds here. He was 80, and he chose women who were looking for senior men. The ad said things like, I definitely do not snore, looking for a financially secure gentleman, you know, must be a gentleman, I'd still drive. You know, it's kind of hilarious. So I called these women, and every time, thank goodness I got their answering machines, because I wouldn't know what to do. You know, hi, my name is Bob Morris. I'm calling on behalf of my father, Joe Morris, who saw your ad in the personal page. Anyway, I got their voicemails, but here's the thing. I didn't like the sound of the voice.
Huh.
Oh, that one sounds too harsh. Or, oh, I don't know, my dad really doesn't like, you know, tough Brooklyn broads. Or, I don't know, this one sounds way too anxious. Or, that's not funny. You know, her message, that's not funny. And I hung up on all of them. I thought to myself, man, are we being picky on behalf of our father? So what was that about? Could I not imagine a new woman replacing my mother who had been with us 50 years, you know, and who was going to come into our family?
Did you find yourself screening for, as ridiculous as it was, yeah, screening for a new mom?
A new mom? Yeah. Screening for a new maternal figure in the family, yes. Or trying very hard not, because I'm such a terrible controlling, I mean, I wrote for the style section for 8 years. How neurotic is that, you know? But so I was trying to control who would be at our Thanksgiving dinner table. You know what I mean? It's like,
you didn't want someone in a velour tracksuit and purple hair.
Well, now that is very classist of you, Krista. I wasn't going to say that. Yes, definitely I didn't need the purple hair. I probably didn't need the velour tracksuit. But what I also didn't need was somebody who was going to be high maintenance or nervous or in any way ruin the possibility of me and my dad finally getting along in our later years.
Yeah, you write that you had always loved your father, but for the longest time you didn't much like him. Can you explain that?
Yeah. I knew deep down that he was a good man and that he had done his best. He was an orphan. He never really saw what it was like to raise children. You know, he didn't learn that at home. And he liked to have a good time. He definitely was in love with his tennis games, and maybe that was a huge priority for him. But he was also a provider, and he was available enough. He was a good guy. I couldn't say I'm Augustine Burroughs and I had a psychotic, you know, torturing father in my hands. On the other hand, I found myself being very critical of him. You know, for things that didn't really matter that much. For example, him being a little bit of a coach when we played tennis together, or the fact that maybe he liked to shop at the discount department store for poor quality shoes, or the fact that he loved, loved, loved going to cheap restaurants with salad bars. Now, how do these things turn into, like, an emotional Armageddon between a father and a son? I don't know, but I suspect that it's not uncommon.
Well, those are the things that we hit on so that we don't have to think about what really bothers us, don't you think?
Oh, that's a good boy. Now, I don't go to therapy, but that was a good question. Ask that one again. Let me think about that.
Yeah, the things that you feel like are embarrassing or that you dwell on usually stand for something else.
You know what? I think that that's true. I mean, I am an aggressively, horribly conflicted, ambitious New Yorker who is surrounded by... Well, you have a big social scene in Dallas, too. I mean, you know what that's like.
I'm not part of it, but yes, we do.
Yeah, there's, you know, these glossy magazines with these, you know, whatever, celebrity socialites. And, you know, that whole world, I have to say, attracted me more, probably because I was writing for the New York Times, the style section. So I had that. I knew what it was, what the ultimate and... genteel, you know, living was like. And yet I had Mr. Magoo driving a toxic, you know, a toxic, you know, crappy little car around. You know what I mean? So I, but probably part of me wished that I was from, a more social world, that my parents were more sophisticated. And ultimately, deeper down, I probably wished I was more accomplished as a human being. And not so lonely, and that, you know, happily partnered and married. And so you're right. You know, I was a little bit quick to be angry with him. On the other hand, Chris, what if you had a parent who would call in pushy suggestions for stories you should do all day long?
It would make me crazy.
Uh-huh. And maybe you're a nicer person than I am, but I wasn't quite able to just take a breath and appreciate the fact that he loved me and he was proud of me and just say, you know what, that's a great idea, Dad.
And then just let it go.
Right.
Bob Morris is my guest. His new book is called Assisted Loving, True Tales of Double Dating with My Dad. So you had some additional criteria. Your dad wanted someone who was not overweight, who liked to dance, and who would play bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And you added your own sort of additional criteria to that. What did he think about when you thought about dating people? Did he have a perfect partner in mind for you?
Oh, that's great. No. In fact, to his credit, he was far more open than I was to people. I call him in the book the world's most democratic Republican. he was not... I've had all kinds of people in and out, and they were all incredibly welcome. So, no, he did not have a kind for me. I'll tell you the kind that I had for me. I wanted somebody who was nothing like me, because I say in the book that I'm not my type. So my whole life was about pursuing something other, probably in a thinly, probably in a quite an obvious way. I didn't like who I was or who I was from, and so I wanted somebody opposite, or at least physically opposite and with a different attitude and a different family background.
Which is funny, and I don't think this sort of gives everything away. It's a great story, but the guy that you ended up with, you two look so much alike that people often mistake you for brothers.
Are you two brothers?
We get at the Lowe's, you know. Do you,
but your dad loved that, right?
Home Depot. Are you two brothers? I once wrote a column about that, like thinking, is that polite? I'm not sure. Like, are people just so living in some other world that they would look at two guys who both happen to have salt and pepper hair and, you know, okay, relatively prominent noses, and then assume that we're brothers, I guess, right?
Well, I guess they have to make conversations
somehow.
I hate
that, though. You know, so it's I just found it very embarrassing. But my dad just didn't care, and the unbelievably crazy thing is that even though I ended up with somebody a lot more worldly and a tremendously elegant person and accomplished and witty and all these things, there's a little bit of my dad in him. It just kills me. Like when I looked over in the car one day when we were driving, that Ira sings as beautifully as my father sang his whole life and can really hold a melody perfectly, I was in shock. I was like, oh my God, I've loved singing with my father my whole life. It was the one thing that would really keep us together as a father and a son. You know, because we ran out of things to talk about. So we always sang. And I'm with somebody who can sing really well. It's freaky how little you know about yourself.
Do you think that came as a surprise to you in part because you are gay? Because I think a lot of straight people are aware, whether we like it or not, that there are qualities of our parents in the people that we choose.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I think that I didn't know that I was never able to say to my dad, God, I love you. You know, God, there are things about you that just have made me laugh my whole life. And maybe some of them are silly things and maybe a little of them are at your expense, but you have given me more material at dinner parties than anybody. So I just don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I know that basically, you know, my book is really about his hunt. And the joy of being able to get down on the page the details of the conversation, you know, the time that I was so furious because he was dating as hard as he could, but not, he was failing, as I was. And one horrible night in Florida, after I went to dinner with somebody I was really trying to push on him because she was very rich, and realized it was no good, I said, okay, Dad, we better take a break. We can talk about this after your break.
Thank you very much for introducing the break. Bob Morris is here. We will be back with him in just a minute. The book is called Assisted Loving, True Tales of Double Dating with My Dad. If you want to talk to Bob, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Thank you.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer, playwright, and former Age of Dissonance columnist for the New York Times, Bob Morris. His new book is called Assisted Loving, True Tales of Double Dating with My Dad. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. So, Bob, you were telling us about the failed experience with this Fifth Avenue Florence, as you
right,
call her.
Right, yes. My father, you know, I was pushing him on this woman, and she wasn't right for him, but I... Basically, one night it all fell apart at dinner, and so we went back to his apartment. This is in Palm Beach, and, you know, we're both in despair. I've had a terrible bout of bad dates over the winter, and it's not working out with her. But then the phone rings, and this woman calls who he is so crazy about. She's 86, he's 80, and I hit the roof when I found that out. She was older than he was, which I just didn't understand. But worse, she had two other boyfriends who were 90. So she was basically double-dealing my dad, and she had these two other guys. He knew it. He didn't care, because the seniors, we'll talk about this if you want to later, like, they have their own little dating and romance rules anyway. So he didn't care that he was number three. And the next day, I found myself visiting my father in Florida by driving him and this woman in the back seat of my rental convertible. And I couldn't believe it. I was like the chaperone watching these two cuddling up in the back seat, she between number boyfriends one or two. I mean, she must have had a hiatus or something that week. And I couldn't stand it. You know, I was just so anxious for him. But then, you know, I was hoping that maybe he would, like, kind of make the moves and really get, you know, kind of win her over so that he could have what he wanted, which was her all the time. But, you know, she kissed him goodbye, and he and I went back to his apartment, and I was just livid, and he didn't care. And he said, you know what? She makes me happy. It's good enough for now. Stop judging my happiness, which I thought was pretty right on, you know, in a way, because that is what I do. I'm a critic. I'm a pathologically honest person who had always been way too critical of my dad. He said, stop judging my happiness, which kind of struck me. And then he said, you know, I'm really sorry that you haven't been in love yourself, and because I think you're a fantastic person, Bobby. And I said, me? He goes, yes, you're fantastic. And so maybe, even if you never find anybody, maybe you could go and consider becoming a father. Hmm. And I was like, what? You know, like, I don't even have a partner, you know, father. He says, well, you know, these women that, you know, a lot of them are single and they're beautiful, you know, these single women in their late 30s in New York, and, you know, figure out how to make a baby. Just figure that out, you know. I'm sure they'd be thrilled. I said, why? What is the point of my having a child? And he said to me, I will never forget this, he said, because look at what your mother and I got when we had you. And it just killed me. I couldn't believe he loved me that much and that he could say it out loud. And, you know, it was around these times that I started to realize, you know, I better get it together with my father. I better figure out how to get over this ridiculous, whatever it is, critical, narcissistic baby boomer thing where we think that we're smarter than our parents and that we know more than them and we have to create boundaries with them and just let him love me.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Bob, that he was able to, you mentioned that he was sort of critical when you'd play tennis, and he was often absent when you were doing things as a kid, and yet he was able to sort of understand for himself that he loved you completely. I wonder if you were able to realize that he understood that you loved him completely despite all of the neurotic things that made you criticize him.
No, he did not, because I criticized him too much, and every time I did, it put him in a terrible mood, and things would blow up, you know. I mean, long past it was time to stop it, you know. I was still looking to be critical. I don't know why. I guess because in a way I cared about him. But I'll never forget the time that he, I had him out for dinner when my mom was still alive to visit me at the beach on Long Island. And we went out to a nice dinner. But of course, as soon as we got to the dinner table, he started working his cell phone. you know, making calls and taking calls and, you know, setting up a bridge game or something. And, you know, he'd done that to me for the last 10 years, but I criticized him for it. It ruined the dinner. I couldn't believe that our whole evening had combusted, and I remember falling on my hands and knees in front of his car before I left him and my mom and said, "May God strike me dead if I ever criticize you again." And then the thunderstorm came up. I'm not kidding. But, you know, it was biblical. Like, what is this nonsense that I was creating? And I think I'm bold enough to say that we create with our parents. How do we get into these little tensions, these little animosities, you know, children criticizing their parents because the parents are giving the grandchildren ice cream, you know, or they don't like the way the parents, they don't like their parents' condo. You know, there's a lot of conflict out there that just probably is all you need is an adjustment to realize that it's pretty funny.
Yeah, the things that you dwell on.
Just a teeny bit of an adjustment, you know. And I say to people when I read my book out loud, sometimes I'll stop, you know, I'll put down the book, and if I had glasses, I would take them off, you know, and I would say, "Now, why don't we all try this one line together? Just can you say these words? You know what, Dad? You're right." Just that. You know, like, even when he's wrong, just try it. You know, just because why do we have to defend ourselves so much? And who is right and who is wrong in a family when you're not really talking about criminal actions?
Well, you know, there's no other relationship in the world that is as dynamic as that of a parent and a grown child. Because you start out, the parent starts out with this child completely helpless, doing every single thing. The kid can't do anything without the parents. And then you move into adulthood, and you don't need that anymore. And so you have to kind of create a brand new thing.
And also consider, speaking of brand new thing, consider what my book is about, which is the year that my mom is gone, and there's a new relationship that is evolving with my father.
Yeah.
He's single. He wants to be friends of all things. You know, we don't have my mother to worry and discuss anymore and to make, you know, when you're with when your mother is as sick as my mother was for so long and such a worry and there's such sadness, you know, especially to a husband whose backbeat is jaunty and happy, it takes a lot out of you. And suddenly she's gone. And he's not interested in the decorum of putting a veil over his head, you know, and mourning and being very somber about it. He's honest enough to say, "I've only got a few years left. I'm going to go have a good time."
Well, and you were still getting over being disappointed with the way he had cared for her when she was
sick.
Yeah,
my brother even more than me. You know, it's just, he had done his best. And that's the other thing that ultimately I came to in the writing of this book is that we do our best. That was the best he could do. And I don't think my best was that much better either. I mean, both my dad and I are very self-involved people. You know, we're always trying to figure out how to have a good time despite the worst circumstances. When my mother wasn't well, I would come away happy that I made her happy by being entertaining. So it was good for both of us. You know, having a parent who's unwell is an opportunity, really, but you have to be able to see it that way. And so, you know, all the times that I spent with my parents, as bored as I could have been, I figured out ways to make it fun for us.
Bob Morris is my guest. The book is called Assisted Loving, True Tales of Double Dating with My Dad. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. One thing that was pretty surprising is for you, and I guess for all of us who read the book, is the dating and mating habits of 21st century elderly Americans.
Yeah.
For one thing, sex was not out of the question.
Sex is certainly not out of the question, but hey, people are living into their 90s now. That population has doubled in the last 10, 15 years. So first of all, 80 isn't really as old as it used to be.
It's the new 70.
You know, Viagra doesn't seem to be causing a lot of problems. You know, you'd think that there would just be some kind of horrible backlash from it, you know, but it seems to be staying the course. And yes, Botox, plastic surgery, there's not a stigma around trying really hard to be youthful. And then, of course, in a Sex and the City culture, where that's just, it's become common to be able to talk about all kinds of things, you can imagine that this is a climate in which seniors are going to thrive in their dating. And they're not going to be so worried about what we think of it anymore. So it is a hot little scene. And, you know, there are all kinds of women out there. The ones that we think are funniest are what I call the casserole widows or the brisket brigade, you know, the ones who show up at the funeral, at the home after the death of a wife with nice, fresh-cooked meals. So that, those are the casserole widows.
Kind of working their way in.
But, you know, then there's also this whole world of women who actually wouldn't trade their cat for a man at that point. You know, they have each other, they have good social networking, and they don't really need it. But the men are helpless. A lot of the men are helpless, and not just because they're looking, you know, what is it? They're not just looking for love, they're looking for lunch.
Mm-hmm. Someone who can cook and clean.
Right, but also, I think someone who emotionally will be there with them. Now, my dad didn't need to cook and clean, as you might know, because he was such a pig it didn't matter. And he was perfectly happy with his doggy bags from diners and making putting pineapple and tuna fish on his own. He didn't need anybody to cook and clean. He needed somebody to hold hands with and sing to in the elevator and charm and dance with on the balcony and go to the movies with. And so for him, it was all about love. It was all about the romance of it. Imagine that, like a boy going to a prom is what he really became.
Did it make you think about aging in a different way when you saw him going through all this? Because some of the things that you've described sound almost like, you know, like a teenager. And after 50 years, I guess it was brand new to him in some ways.
It was brand new. I used to, you know, I found myself having to introduce myself to the children of the women he was dating who were grown adults. You know, as if, and they were looking, eyeing him suspiciously, as if they were the parent looking at their child go off to the prom. Suddenly, who is my mother? Who is this that my mother is dating? Who is this Joe Morris? So it does make you think differently about aging. And it also gave me and a lot of readers of the book hope in the fact that it's never too late. You know, look at how, you know, 50 years he was out of the dating picture. He was a very faithful man. And he didn't find it right away. It took him a little while to settle in to meet somebody. But me, I was well over 45 when I finally figured out that love is not perfect, but it is a decision. And that's another thing my dad taught me. You know, you've got to stop looking for perfection in somebody. And then you might find it.
Yeah, you write that he coughed up the hairball of meaning you'd been looking for from him your whole life. That's one
right.
of my favorite lines in the whole
right.
book.
Oh, thank you. Yes, by accident. He was concerned for me. He wanted me to have love in my life, and he said to me, "Stop looking for perfection. That's the only way you'll find it." And so I did. And I have him to thank. You know, he passed away a couple of years ago. And I think of him all the time now because I am, you know, happily and legally married, you know, in California.
Oh, that's right. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. I was in L.A. a lot because there's been a lot of movie and TV interest in assisted living, which is great. And so between meetings, I hired marriagetogo.com. No joke, and had like a 1 hour really lovely ceremony. And so now we'll see how long that lasts. But so that, you know, my dad was totally present in that ceremony in which the officiant, the woman who was doing the ceremony, said, you know, love is, it's a promise, and it's also a choice. And most importantly, it's something that you have to keep reinventing over and over and revisiting over and over. And the only thing that I could do at that ceremony was to sing the song that I used to sing with him and sing it to Ira.
And what's that song?
Till There Was You. Hmm. You know it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's funny, I'm so glad that they met. I'm so glad that they met, although I could have lived without Ira asking him what the sex was like. To which my father replied, you know, with the pills they have today and the positive effects of the hernia surgery I had last year, I could go all night if I want.
Your dad didn't turn around and ask Ira the same question, did he?
No. Thank you very much.
Now, it is funny because one of the striking things in the book is your dad asks you for some advice. He says, well, you know, where should I be when I kiss this my date goodnight? And the issue is that he just had a hip replaced and he had to figure out sort of how to get himself in the right position.
I'm not sure if that was right after the hip surgery or not. When he had a hip replacement, it wasn't that I was advising him. Well, I sort of was advising him because there were a lot of attractive women in this rehab center. You know, because hip replacement, you're not sick. You know, it's an elective surgery, and it might as well be plastic surgery or something. So I noticed that there was a good gaggle of women that seemed to be eyeing him at the dinner table.
So you're scoping for chicks while your father is convalescing from a hip replacement.
Yes, absolutely. I said, you should be. Well, look, part of it was if he was happy, then he'd leave me alone. If I could foist him off and get him turning his romantic hood lights on one of these women who would take to him because he was a handsome and charming guy, then I wouldn't feel so guilty about him being lonely. So, you know, see what I mean? I mean, it's all about me. It always was all about me. But in terms of advice about dating, it wasn't. What really happened was I would try to coach him on how to use his knife and fork properly. Or, you know, suggests that maybe he needs to understand the idea of dry cleaning or that, you know, maybe it wasn't such a good idea to burst out into conversation when his mouth was full of food. Things like that where I was just basically coaching him like a little etiquette teacher. You know, in terms of making the moves on people, I might have said a little of this and that, but ew, Chris, ew.
Well, I mean, you call this book Double Dating with My Dad. You know?
And it was. A couple of times there were double dates, but just as often were the unseemly situations of him showing up with a woman on his arm when I was supposed to see him alone. Heck.
Bob Morris is my guest. The book is called Assisted Loving, True Tales of Double Dating with My Dad. We'll return after the break. If you want to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
Listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Bob Morris is my guest. He's a writer, playwright, and the former columnist who wrote, he's still a columnist, but he once wrote the Age of Dissonance column for the New York Times. His book is called Assisted Loving, True Tales of Double Dating with My Dad. You mentioned earlier that your dad was a Republican, and in the book you write that he was a great defender of George W. Bush. Does that narrow the dating pool for an 80-year-old Jewish guy on the North Shore of Long Island?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Not to mention in Palm Beach.
Yeah.
You know, which, yeah, definitely. And it got so bad that there were times when he came close to overturning tables on dates over politics. You know, my aunt, who is 90, my Aunt Sylvia, described the time that she had him over for a Passover Seder, and the topic of Iraq came up. And, you know, at that point, many people had no question about, you know, how unhappy they were about it. And he got himself into the position of defending his beloved president and ruined the dinner. Nice job, Dad. So, you know, you know, the dating pool is there's three women available to every man. So I don't think that he suffered that much for ideas.
So you talked about the fact that there have been movie offers and TV interest and all that. I would imagine the casting of whoever would play your father would be really important to you.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, you know, it's too bad that Don Rickles is such a pain in the neck. He would be great, you know, because he has, there's something, you look at that guy, you know, even though he spits venom, he's kind of a lovable looking face, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But who knows? I mean, I'll tell you one thing for sure. There's a very available cast of revolving lady dates, senior ladies. You know, you could bring out your Cloris Leachmans and your Diane Carrolls and your, you know, Betty Whites. And you know, I mean, people would love to see that again. So, you know, we're talking about what kind of show it would be right now. And I think that the idea is that it's that weekly visit to a dad that I'd love it to be about, you know, every time trying really hard to make this the visit where you don't just love your father, but you start to like him and failing at every point.
We should talk about the cover photograph, because that is actually not, for people who've seen the book, and you can check it out on Amazon, your father.
No, it's not my father. I was going to say assistedloving.com is pretty, it's a pretty educational thing for any boomer who's going through this with an aging parent.
And there's a great video of your dad on there, too.
And there is. But the cover, actually, we didn't have a good, this just shows you what little respect, I guess, I had. You know, we didn't have a great photograph. And so this is, the cover is of this old man in his 90s sitting on the beach, tan as can be, covered in jewelry, and eating a pastrami sandwich like there's no tomorrow, like with such vitality and such happiness, such joy to be alive, you know, to hell with everything, we're going to have a good afternoon here. And that was my dad. And so I feel like that was the scene that my dad was functioning in, you know, this world, especially in Palm Beach, where, you know, their seniors just go wild. They don't have their kids around to judge them, and they just want to have a good time. So I was hoping that that would reflect the idea of the world of the book.
There is, in the back of the book, a terrific picture of you and your father, and there's actually a great physical resemblance that's obvious there, but your dad appears to be wearing the jacket that you write about in the book.
Yes. God bless him. He never wanted to spend money on clothes, which was a terrible, it wasn't great for a style-obsessed son to have a dad who only wanted to buy blazers for $49.
It only happens that way, though, doesn't it? I mean, it never kind of works out that everybody's on the same page there.
No, we were not. But at the end of his life, he just threw me. You know, when he was 80, he bought himself the most impeccable blazer at Brooks Brothers, which I assumed he got on clearance sale, but he bought it full price, $500 for a blazer, which shocked me. But he said that he did it because he knew I would love it, and he loved it himself. And some kind of a strange sun coming out from behind the clouds for us. And I know that sounds ridiculous. I know that it shouldn't matter, that I really cared that he looked so beautiful in this jacket, which I think he was putting on to meet Ira for the first time. But I thought, God, my God, maybe I've rubbed off on him. And then I started disliking myself for rubbing off on him in that way over something as material as a sports jacket.
Well, it's pretty sweet that he wanted to please you as much as himself.
So sweet. It's too bad that then he reached in the pocket and found a half of a tooth that he had lost bagel at dinner, you know, which was actually in a dried, blood-speckled Kleenex. Never anything was just right. You
so
know?
You knew it was still him.
Yeah, it was still him.
So your dad and Ira got along really well, but there's one scene where I guess you're leaving your dad's apartment, and Ira says basically, I knew as soon as I saw that apartment that I was marrying your father.
Yes, I still have a habit of leaving drawers open sometimes, and boy, if I'm running out of the apartment for a meeting, even though I'm home all day writing, yeah, it can be pretty messy. And the fact that Ira says that makes me so angry that he's saying that he's married Joe Morris. Bob Morris is becoming Joe Morris, which of course is true. My body is becoming like my father's body. We have the same paunch, you know. I'm getting like the same markings on my skin that he got, the same silvering hair, the same, you know, loss of posture. I mean, it's all happening. I'm 50 years old. I am becoming my father, and it on the one hand, it infuriates me when Ira says that. On the other hand, I don't think I could hear anything more lovely in my life.
Mm-hmm. What do you hear now, Bob, from people who have read the book and have gone on the website and said, this is exactly what I'm trying to go through with my parents?
Yeah, no, I hear it a lot. I think the nicest thing I ever heard was from a very sophisticated Manhattan theater producer I know who said, she closed the book and she called up her parents in Michigan and said, I'm coming out for 3 weeks with the kids. So to have the longest visit they'd ever had. And that was the nicest thing I heard. And then, yeah, I've gotten a lot of responses. Strangely, a lot of people from all different worlds are responding to this book. In other words, people half my age, for some reason, are very conflicted about why they have such a difficult time embracing their parents. And other people who, well, a lot of people who have aging parents are relating to it. So I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not so sure that the seniors, I don't know what the seniors think of this book, actually. It's tricky to know whether they want to read about their own world or they would rather just live in the fantasy world of, you know, younger people in movies. I don't know. But I know that it's, when I was doing the assisted living on the stage in New York, there were lots of seniors that came with their boomer age kids. So it's kind of my goal is I'd like this book to kind of be able to reach both ages. Tuesdays with Morris.
Have you, I'm not trying to play your therapist here, but have you figured out why you were not able to tell your dad that you just loved him completely while he was alive?
No, I mean, I think that I'm finally starting to get there. I think that, no, it's a good question, though. I don't know why. I think that by the end he did know because I was there at his side so much when he was really suffering and ill for a year, and I was the one who was out there sitting with him in the lobby of his assisted living place and singing to him and playing the piano for all his friends and taking him for drives and allowing him to be really sad when his body was failing him and he knew he just wanted to go. And I allowed all of that. And so I know that he knows that I loved him, but I could never quite be full on positive with him. That's all. And to say, well, you know, that's fantastic, Dad. You know what? You tried to get up and walk with me across the parking lot and, you know, you're too weak to do it. So that's fine. Instead, I would say, come on, I'm disappointed. You know, I need you to try a little harder. I don't want you to lose, you know, you lose the muscle tone in your legs, so let's keep walking. So I nagged him a bit to the end. But you know what? He did the same thing to me. Even. Like, you know, nagging me that my visits weren't long enough. You know, I'd like it if you put a little more time in out here. You know, I'm thinking, Jesus, I just come out to Great Neck from the city to spend a few hours, but that's not enough. And when I got really upset when he said that once, you know, like, how dare you insult me by saying my time is so unvaluable that I should just spend days and days and days with you? You know what my brother said? He said, it's pretty awful, but you know what, Bob? Isn't it wonderful that he loves you so much?
That he wants you there.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting thing that you say you allowed him to be sad, because I think a lot of people who have an elderly parent or a sick parent, they still can't, the child in them can't face the fact that the parent is dying and they don't want to talk about that. And, you know, a lot of elderly people seem to want to talk about their own demise a lot because it's right there in front of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, how dare they get old, right?
Yeah.
How dare my parents who raised me and are supposed to be not making problems in my life because I've got enough problems with my own children and my own career and my own hair coloring. How dare these people get sick and become this issue? And, you know, in my dad's case, being Joe Morris, he decided that he wanted to check out because his heart was going and there was no way to fix it. You know, he's just losing strength. And he really wanted to go. And in fact, at the end, took 5 Ambien and left a very long note, you know, thinking that would be the end. It was basically a meek gesture at suicide. But what we found out in the emergency room when he was coming to, and basically his old perky self within, you know, 8 hours, you know, was that you could take a whole bottle of that and it's not going to do you in. And so Ira said to him, Joe, Listen, it's nice to see you. You know, just so you know, I take about 5 Ambien when I get to the Frankfurt Book Fair in Germany to get a good night's sleep. Isn't that awful? It's transgressive as hell, right? It's very transgressive. But, you know, the fact is that my father had to then live out a last year that he didn't want to live. And because he was such a dramatic person, he wanted us to know that his way would have been the right way. He loved being right. And so now he was stuck living it out. And, you know, having to feel that he was a burden to his two sons. And so I felt not like cheering him up. I would do what we love to do together and take my cue from him. And so we sang most of the time. We just sang for hours on end. I had beautiful, beautiful books of lyrics of all the old Cole Porter and George Gershwin, and I played the piano and the ukulele, and that's how we passed a lot of the time, which made him happy. But if he was unhappy, I think he had a right to talk about that. And I didn't mind doing it. In fact, I would encourage it. And I just felt that that was his due, that that was full expression. That, you know, it wasn't just about cheering up. And you know what? Things are going to be okay. You know, I never said that. I said, it's horrible, isn't it, Dad? This is, can you imagine, could you even imagine? This is your worst, the worst nightmare. But I still had a good time with you today, so I'll see you next week.
Could he still sing at the end?
Oh, yeah. Right to the end. Oh, my God. Right to the end. Right until the hours in the hospital when he was really expiring, and I knew he had been looking forward to that for a year. In fact, he had instructed my brother and I that he wanted to be gone by Friday. That was the lawyer and my dad, and the controlling man.
Wrap up the week of
business. Yeah, please, now that I'm in the hospital, now that I've had this really bad heart situation, that there's a pump in me that should be pulled, Friday. And so the day had come, and my brother and I were sitting across the bed, his bed from him in this quiet room, and my brother said to me, why don't you sing to him? And my father whispered, no singing, you know, meaning he was drifting finally out to this place he wanted to be. And so I said to my brother, okay, you heard it. Dad said no. And my brother said, no, come on, please, just something. So I think I sang You Are My Sunshine or something. And I was furious with my brother. Like, how dare he override my father's opinion? But after I finished singing, my father whispered, beautiful. Hmm. So I guess I was singing to the end.
Is there any part of you that wishes that you hadn't had that year, that it had gone the way he wanted it to?
No, because, you know, this sounds terrible, but I was very lucky that I was very lucky to be there for the passing of both my parents right there.
Bob Morris is a writer, commentator, and playwright. The book is called Assisted Loving, True Tales of Double Dating with My Dad. Bob, thank you so much for sharing the hour with us.
Oh, thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.